But most of all, what I wish I'd known decades ago is that the setting up the boundary, the saying what you need, what you want, it's the having compassion for yourself, the holding yourself while you wait. Like when you have grown up knowing that you're not safe to set a boundary, to say what you need, that can be incredibly triggering. So holding yourself, having support, knowing you are not wrong to want whatever it is you want, to need whatever it is you need.
Welcome to Good Enough Counsellors, the podcast for growing a private practice without the pressure to be perfect. I'm Josephine Hughes, counsellor and creator of Therapy Growth Group, helping you get the clients you want and create the practice of your dreams. Today I'm joined by someone who brings such a grounded, compassionate approach to well-being, the wonderful Eve Menounos Cunningham. Eve brings together therapy, coaching, yoga and writing in a way that feels both creative and deeply embodied. She moved to rural Ireland after Brexit, where she now lives with a beautiful view of the local mountain and a small family of feral cats alongside her own much-loved Rainbow Magnificat, who often appears in Eve's social media. Eve's long been involved in our profession, both as a therapist and a supervisor. She's been chair of the BACP coaching division, and more recently, she was the editor-in-chief of the Irish Journal of Counselling and Psychotherapy. Eve has written a book, 365 Ways to Feel Better, Self-Care Ideas for Embodied Wellbeing, and she has a podcast, Feel Better Every Day with Eve Menounos Cunningham. And because January can bring such a rush of pressure to reset, to improve, to be different, I thought this was the perfect moment to invite Eve on. Her work offers a much gentler, wiser way of approaching the new year, especially for those of us who often put themselves right at the bottom of the list. So let's dive in. Welcome, Eve.
Thank you so much for having me.
No, it's lovely. It's really lovely to have you here. And I'll probably have you on more than once, to be honest, because I was just saying before the podcast, we've got absolutely so much we could talk about because you've done so much over time, haven't you?
Yeah.
But obviously, one of the things that you really is a real sort of big part of you, because you embody this so much, your well-being, and I know you share a lot with me about that, is really about how to look after ourselves in January. And I think we can put ourselves under so much pressure, but it can often be a quiet time as well. And we get all sort of worried and upset and, you know, we don't know what we're going to be doing about inquiries. So what do you think we need to be mindful of in January?
Well, it was funny to hear you describe my kind of wisdom and compassion and all, because I need to do more of that for myself as well. It's like I'm constantly trying to soothe the self-talk. And I think it's that ADHD brain as well, the wanting to do all the things now, wanting the routines, needing the routines, hating being told what to do, the pathological demand avoidance, also known as persistent drive for autonomy.
Yeah, like that.
So even if it's me saying, right, I'm going to be doing do, it's like, don't tell me what to do. So yes, it's like all of that going on. So I guess over the years, over the decades, it's finding ways of helping myself move in the directions I want to be moving in. Mm. So even their directions, not just one direction. And also trying to do it in a more compassionate way and helping. It's much easier with clients and supervisees in groups, much, much easier, because I hear the insanity of what they're suggesting. Whereas when it's all in my own head, it's like, no, I should be able to do it all.
Yeah, because I think it's interesting that you've already talked about being a ADHD as well, because that's sort of like a fairly recent thing for you, isn't it, to have found that out?
So I was waiting for the diagnosis for the ADHD for years. Yeah. And I'd done an autism like self-assessment and I'd scored quite high, but because I didn't even know if I was deluding myself about ADHD, I just kind of didn't really go there. But then when I started the medication for the ADHD, and apparently this happens a lot, the ADHD symptoms stopped masking the autism symptoms, so it became much more obvious. Yeah. So I've not had a formal autism diagnosis. My psychiatrist said I have it, but I would need to do like formal assessment. But again, with that, until 2013, people didn't think that one person could have both. Whereas now they recognise most people either with autism or with ADHD also have autism or ADHD. There is an enormous, and especially with women. So I think as diagnostic criteria is improving, I know, like, I'm on the medication, not every day because of side effects, but I take the medication enough to make a positive impact. I'm not on any kind of medication for the autism, but it helps with the self-compassion and the understanding, and like, especially like you say, a busy time of year, all the hopes for the new year, all the excitement. And yeah, I think I'm not sure if I've answered your question there.
It's just really fascinating, though, I think, when you do discover this about yourself. And do you think it helped you to be more compassionate towards yourself once you'd found out about it?
I think the more we know about ourselves, the more we can make sense of all sorts of things. Like, for me, understanding about, like, my complex trauma background through a house fire back in 2008. That's what led me to then train as a therapist. Before that, I'd been coaching, I'd been doing EFT, like other things. But I think just knowing that it's not just you, you're not broken, that you're worthy, you're lovable, you're not too much, you are enough. Because I used to feel like both not enough and too much at the same time, which again, ADHD explains so much around the conflict. But also, I'm Indian Irish, London born, so the multicultural bit has that as well. So I don't know, like, I couldn't categorically say such and such element is because of this or because of that or that, but overall, I think the more we know about ourselves, the more we can be curious and compassionate with ourselves, the more about life we're moving into that kind of ventral vagal state in the polyvagal informed way of working. So even when things are hard, even a little bit of curiosity, it begins to shift into ventral vagal, into that kind of safety connection, rather than sympathetic survival stress.
I mean, so much sort of came up there just in your answer. Even I've got the, you know, nice little plan as to what we're going to talk about.
Apologies.
I'm going to jump right through. We'll be a bit sort of, you know, we can be ADHD together. Because I think, you know, one of the things that I think, as I've sort of followed you over the years, that comes across so much in what you write about and the way you share is your care and compassion for others. And I think that, comes across in so many ways. Like you mentioned there that you're Indian Irish. So, you know, when it was the time of, say, the time when we were sort of looking at sort of Black Lives Matter, you wrote a lot then about this sort of deep sense of empathy for, you know, for people. I know sort of other political situations also sort of impact you quite a lot, don't they? And this is something you actually talk about quite a lot, don't you? And I just wonder, for those of us who perhaps, you know, like myself, who's sort of quite new to this sort of thing, you know, where perhaps I've sort of been quite privileged, but now sort of realising there's so much more and that I need to be, you know, for me, more of an activist. But it's so painful, isn't it, to look at the world and see what's going on. And I just wondered if you've got any tips that you could help those of us who sort of are on that sort of journey of understanding more about lack of privilege in other people and how we can get involved. How do you cope? Because I know it's something that you've talked about a lot.
Yeah, and I think my own boss, I've been doing this for 21 years, adding different elements as I've trained and qualified in them. But before that, and I obviously we've just talked a little bit about ADHD, neurodivergent justice sensitivity, it helps me have a better understanding of why from a really early age it was. I mean, I was absolutely heartbroken last week watching a film with my partner about, it was called Death of a Unicorn. I did not expect it to be so brutal.
Really?
And I was basically like, I don't want to be human anymore. It was absolutely... Oh. We haven't finished watching it. I've Googled spoilers. It's meant to be a satire. The unicorn represents nature. But I used to, in my last job in London, I would be walking around the open plan office sobbing because my taxes were being used to bomb Afghanistan and Iraq. Yeah. And I'd been on so many protests, and I was going to like weekly kind of meetings for campaigning for Ministry for Peace, hoped that the change, the reframe towards peace, people working towards a peaceful world would. But I burnt out. I had no idea. Yeah, the whole Black Lives Matter, George Floyd, the way like RTE, the equivalent of BBC over here in Ireland, they kept showing him being murdered without any kind of warning. In a way, if they'd show something far less triggering about a white person, there'd have been all sorts of warnings. And the othering, the I sound English, I look white, but I am kind of very aware of inequality. With the whole Brexit thing, it was like realizing I'd grown up thinking that English people were ashamed about the empire and the horrors inflicted in Ireland, in India, in Africa, in so many parts of the world, and then realizing so many people harked back to that as if it were a good thing. And now, so I kind of, I feel more hopeful now than I did as a suicidal teenager who wanted to be dead much of the time because it was like humans suck. That's not helpful. So I think growing into my power is a huge thing. I think the more we all step into our power and like look after our nervous systems, my focus with the framework I work with, it's self-care, like the regulatory stuff, it's self-care, remembering we're all connected. So like when you talked about Black Lives Matter and the empathy, I can be very hyper-empathic, which does me and no one else any good. When the riots in London, I remember my supervisor at the time was in Brixton. I was born in Tottenham. I was sobbing on the train from Essex and got to her, are you okay? Because like she's like, I think you were more affected than I was. Like, I'm fine. And I'd be, it doesn't help anyone when we're that raw, when we're that, our suffering helps no one. But recognising, okay, I feel strongly about whatever it is, and I need to do this to sort myself out, to regulate, and then I'm going to be there in whatever way I can be. So a lot of my work helping other people heal from trauma, befriend their brains, remember they're not broken, and find ways of contributing to like collective care, especially with what's going on in America. Like, I mean, there's so much horror in so many places, but the more we don't let our nervous systems be hijacked, the more we connect with that highest, wisest, truest part of ourself. Remember, we're all part of nature, we're all part of the divine. So like I do a lot of loving kindness meditation. There's research around compassion being better than empathy in terms of burnout, avoiding burnout. And I think also there's going to be less charge if we're all burning out, if we're all getting so raw and fraught and heartbroken, it doesn't help anyone. Whereas if we're able to have compassion and to remember the areas we can impact and do what we can, whether in whatever way it might be, and compassion for ourselves as well, for not being, my name's Eve, I feel guilty for everything, it's all my fault. So I'm still working with that.
Yeah. It's a lot in a name, isn't there? So Eve, I'm sort of interested then, you said that compassion was found to be more effective than empathy. And I just wondered, could you define what you mean by, I'm just curious, how do you mean? What's the difference between compassion and empathy?
So compassion, I was going to say it's a bit more distant. It's a bit more removed. Empathy, you're feeling it. Like you're in there. You're an open wound. You're sobbing. You're shaking. You're like kind of really feeling it. And it's like it's happening to you.
Yeah.
You're disempowered.
Yeah.
With compassion. So Kristin Neff has done a huge amount of research around self-compassion. Really worth looking into. But when we're having that compassion towards ourselves for not being able to do more than we wish we could, and for others. So I heard someone recently talking about he encourages his coaching students to watch the news.
Yeah.
I think it was Richard Davison, who's done a lot, an American neuroscientist. Mm. We studied him when I was doing the yoga therapy. Mm. But I think it was him, and he was saying that he wanted to see how long they could watch the news before they started getting judgmental.
Oh,
so there's
yeah.
an enormous amount to be horrified by in the world, an enormous, like, the media outlets that are hijacking our nervous systems in order to keep us engaged, to give us those dopamine hits when we find out what the thing they were alluding to actually is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's up to us to remember the people who are helping, the people who... So after 9/11, the American one in New York, there was a lot around Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers. He'd been a pastor turned TV host who did a lot of quiet activism through his program, bringing in marginalized people as ordinary people, because everyone is a person. Like,
yeah.
We're all human, we're all connected, we're all... So he wasn't like kind of out shouting or shaming anyone, but he was using his platform to help give a voice, help represent, and help counter fear-based propaganda about certain marginalized communities.
Yeah.
But there was a quote of his where he said something like, when something bad happened, his mother always told him, look for the helpers.
Yeah.
And I think when we think we're all doomed, like, how could someone be that sadistic? How could they be so cruel? How could they delight in the pain they are amplifying or causing, rather than, oh, wow, so-and-so is doing amazing work. It must feel hopeless at times, but look at them go. That's incredible. I wonder how I can support that, or how that might inspire me. Like,
yeah.
I might have a fraction of the platform they have, or resources or time or anything like that. But it gets you into that more kind of, again, ventral vagal, what I call per. How can you motivate yourself to do something positive rather than go into the dorsal vagal overwhelm freeze? It's all hopeless.
Yeah.
I don't want to be human anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like that idea of focusing on the people who are doing what they can do, because actually, you know, I think the vast majority of us actually do want to do and help. And they often say that when there's a disaster, that people will go out of their way to look after others, won't they?
Yeah.
You know, like, say, turning up to donate blood, for example.
Absolutely.
You know, there's lots of people will be moved and want to do something to help. And I think we can forget that. So I'd love you to share the way you describe, you just alluded it to it there with the ventral vagus part of our system, because you have this lovely way of thinking about using the cats as an example of how the polyvagal system sort of works. You know, I'm the mum of a new cat.
Yeah.
And I can really begin to identify with what you're talking about. So tell us about this, how you sort of like describe it using cats as a metaphor.
So I call it polyvagal pairs now, but I've been working this way since 2013 with Rainbow Magnificat. So I'd first come across polyvagal theory 2011, 2012, and I had anxiety dreams about it because there was so much jargon, but I also loved it. Just that simple idea that 80% of signals go up via the vagus to the brain. So it's so much faster to breathe or move or position ourselves in a way in which we're sending signals of safety up to the brain that then cascades down to the whole nervous system. So then bringing Rainbow back from the shelter in Colchester, and my recognition that trying to keep her in kind of rest digest mode as much as possible, she'd had a tough start in life. It had changed my self-talk. So Stephen Porges, who created polyvagal theory, he talked about tone of voice. So the way we speak to ourselves and others has a direct impact on the vagus nerve. And by talking kindly and gently to Rainbow, I had internalized a kinder voice than I had managed through all those years of coaching and therapy. And it was like, oh.
The miracle of the cat.
Yeah. So I started using it in a really basic way with clients when appropriate. So I'd already, like, I'd used Rainbow in some of my branding. I think it was apparent I was very into cats, well, Rainbow, and I wouldn't always, but I'd encourage people to think about, like, talking the way they would to a beloved cat or kitten or puppy or toddler or anyone, because we're all so much kinder to other people than we are to ourselves. Mm-hmm. And then kind of basically building on that. So I've been working on a book for years. The cats now have their own Instagram accounts.
Yeah.
So if you go to at polyvagalpurs, it will link to the others, but I'm kind of not posting as much as I'd like. But if listeners are members of IACP, I have 3 modules of CPD up, went up a few weeks ago, where I'm now at a stage where I presented at the online events neurodivergence conference on it. And 3 modules basically about the rescue cats and polyvagal informed approaches to trauma and neurodivergence.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it just makes it friendlier and easier to understand. I think just even saying, like, I call ventral vagal, like, purr, because ventral vagal doesn't mean a huge amount to most people.
Yeah.
But that's what we're aiming for in terms of polyvagal theories about the science of safety and connection.
Mm-hmm.
So when we are feeling safe, when we're feeling welcome, when we're loved, we are literally wired to thrive when those things are in place. So if you imagine the world, if you imagine everyone on the planet feeling safe, welcome and loved, and all the problems of the world could be eradicated because the creativity that would be unleashed, the problem solving, all of it. But all we can do is work with ourselves, our communities, and do our best. So it's not about staying in ventral vagal the whole time. We're humans. Life gets messy. Our stress response gets triggered. But recognizing any time we go into sympathetic survival, what I call hiss, it's like, okay, what can I do to get back into ventral vagal? What can I do to get back into purr? So thinking of building up anchors that help you. So it might be people, it might be places, it might be activities, it could be anything that helps you feel purr. So I imagine the kind of tip of that being the kind of cat being open to a belly rub, and it's just so safe and connected. And one false move, murder button activated. And it's like the cat, in being vulnerable, the cat is open to all good things, but the cat is not defenseless. We're not talking about being foolish. We're not talking about giving up our defenses. It's about the balance, the, like, we're all mammals, we're wired for safety and connection. So I then talk about dorsal vagal, the kind of overwhelm, the numbing, the dissociating, the tonic immobility, as freeze. So it's where the system gets overwhelmed. And so again, it's kind of, how can you help yourself move faster? I still go into it, but I don't live there the way when I was a teenager and just thought, what's the point? We're all doomed.
You recognize it and move yourself out.
Do
you have to go through, so say you're in that place, I mean, sort of thinking about the cats, you know, when I first got my cats, they went and hid for a few days, just literally just hid away, you know. Do you have to move through the hiss stage to get back to the purr stage, or can you bypass the hiss stage?
So hiss, like Rainbow, when she came from the shelter, I overwhelmed her nervous system without realising it. First of all, the water bowl I had for her could have drowned the poor creature. It was huge. She was tiny. I didn't know that I should have let her out in a tiny room. I should have let her out in the bathroom and let her build from there. I let her out in the living room and it was too big and she was overwhelmed. She hid behind the bookcase for 36 hours. So I, like, knowing again, tone of voice, when I'd walk past, I'd meow. And
just let her know
we basically, we meowed at each other. Yeah. So I'd like talk to her gently. I couldn't see her. I would also cry. I was panicked that she was somehow trapped behind the drawers at the bottom of the bookcase, and I was going to have to get an emergency handy person out in the middle of the night. Oh. I think it was before Christmas as well.
Yeah.
So I was a bit all over the place. I was like trying to be grounded, trying to be centered, trying to be holding space for her, reassuring her that it was a safe place, she can come out in her own time. But just like if she meowed twice, I'd meow twice. So we were kind of like building up a rapport. Mm. And then when she did come out, she climbed all over me, and we've been really great buddies ever since.
Yeah.
And it felt like she understood my intentions there.
Yeah.
If I hadn't known about the vagus at that point, if I hadn't known about tone of voice, I'd have probably been much harsher with myself about what's wrong with me. Why can't I, like, it must be better here than in the shelter where there were so many cats and so much trauma and all of it. And I'd have been shame spiraling about not being a good enough human for the cat rather than we're all figuring it out. We're all doing our best. And how might we help her feel safer? How?
And I wonder how that, I mean, obviously you talk about sort of helping clients to understand that, but how do you bring it in the way that you sort of like look after clients, for example, you know, when you're working with clients, not necessarily so, psychoeducation, but just being in that place where you're helping clients, like little rainbow, where she went and hid behind the shelves. That sometimes our clients are like that as well, aren't they? They need to hide.
Yeah. And I think it's the knowledge that it's what they need.
Mm.
It's what we all need. Like it's about having compassion for ourselves when we're in dorsal, when we're in sympathetic survival. When I first moved to Ireland, I was in what a friend called a glorified shed. I needed to find somewhere that was rainbow friendly.
Yeah.
And it was tiny. So I had like my chair, and if it were positioned a tiny bit differently, people would have seen into the loo, which had holes in the wall. So I'd always be counting how many spiders I was sharing the shower with. And the other, I had a sleep cupboard on the other side. The move, it happened, I've been planning it for ages, but in the end I only had 9 days to close down. So Rainbow, bless her, we'd been in a B&B for a week, and then we were in this rental, and my landlord, who had the main house, he had dogs, and also he had a lot of work going on, and I was way out of town. It wasn't the 2 miles I'd been told, it was closer to 9 miles.
Oh goodness, yeah.
So I was very isolated. But Rainbow started just living under the duvet a lot of the time. She would spend most of the day under the duvet, and then at night she'd be kind of round on top of the curtain poles and all the rest of it. And because I knew about the vagus, it was like, this creature is phenomenal. And I was alone in a country where I'd always had an Irish passport. I'm an immigrant, but it's also the first time I've lived somewhere I've got a blood link. But there was an enormous amount to sort out, and not driving, I didn't have internet for ages. I was very often out of my depth. And so
really challenging.
So I used Rainbow as a role model, and it's like, okay, I'm going to curl up under the duvet with her. Might be for 10 minutes, it might be for 1 minute, it might be for 20 minutes. But just that acknowledgement, I feel stressed right now. I feel overwhelmed right now. I'm going to do something kind to myself to honour that, rather than I'm going to immediately regulate it away. I'm going to do all the things. It's like, you know what? Just let yourself cry. Let yourself shake. Let yourself, your body knows what it needs.
I'm just going to pause the conversation for a moment to tell you about Therapy Growth Group. If you're a counsellor in private practice and January feels heavy, or you're wanting to move your practice forward without putting more pressure on yourself, this might be helpful. Inside Therapy Growth Group, we focus on taking small, manageable steps rather than trying to fix everything at once. Next week, I'm starting the 12 Action Steps program again. It gently breaks marketing and practice building down into doable actions, things that you can fit around your client work and real life. There's no pressure to keep up. and there's no expectation to be perfect. I'll put a link in the show notes if you'd like to find out more. And now, back to the conversation.
Again, I'm not sure if I've answered your question or if I've gone off.
No, it's really interesting because we're sort of talking about clients. But I mean, what came up for me, because obviously, thought, well, I'll ask Eve to come on and talk to us about self-care in January. Yeah. And it's sort of like, I think often that as therapists, especially in private practice, you know, start of the year, we've got these ideas about what we want to do and things maybe don't happen. That we could easily get into that place where we're in either the sort of hiss or hiding part of our polyvagal system, and we need somehow to move into the purr part.
Sorry, I didn't answer your question where you asked about with clients. Mm. I think, first of all, me having that compassion and me thinking, oh, bless, they're in sympathetic survival, or they're moving into dorsal vagal, or they're in dorsal vagal. So I do use a lot of psychoeducation. So if I talk about that when appropriate, most of them will understand, and the purr, hiss, freeze element.
Yeah.
They don't necessarily want to go there. Sometimes they really do, other times not. But just even me having that kind of awareness of people need to feel safe in order to get curious. Mm. So you might have a client who's really, really as a protective mechanism. Yeah. I didn't used to do that to my poor therapist at all. It wasn't conscious, but I didn't feel safe to be present back then.
Yeah.
So it could be asking myself, oh, I wonder if they're feeling like that. And I think the more people understand that everything is normal, dorsal vagal, far from ideal, kept them alive, kept me alive. Mm. And once we start seeing it all as adaptive survival responses, you wouldn't judge a cat for overreacting. You don't judge, like Peter Levine's work, Waking the Tiger, where he talks about the impala shaking, like after it's played dead to avoid the threat, the perceived threat of the lion.
Yeah.
It doesn't spend the rest of the day beating itself up. Mm. I'm so embarrassed, I misjudged the lion's distance. What? It just shakes it off and gets on with its day.
Yeah.
The more compassion we can have for whatever it is we've done to survive and remind ourselves that we're safe now, and if we're not safe now, figure out how we can make ourselves safe.
Mm.
It's unlearning the conditioning that has taken us away from what we were born knowing. Mm. So it's remembering what we all know. We're part of nature, we're part of the divine. It's all good. Mm. And when we get all the rubbish out the way, things flow. And even when there are difficult situations, we are able to not make them worse by, like, hopefully we can help improve them.
Mm-hmm. What's coming up here for me, and it's a bit of a jump, but it's because I think it's so one of the things you really helped me with was thinking about boundaries and setting boundaries in our practice. Because I think when you say about what we've sort of, you know, we have to unlearn to a certain extent, don't we? Because we come into this with so much conditioning, don't we? And about the way we should be with people and how we, I suppose, really, you know, the sort of fawning, I suppose, we talk about and how, especially if you're a people pleaser, it can be really, really hard to set boundaries. Mm. I know this is something that you've talked about quite a lot, and I just wondered if you could maybe help those of us who find boundary setting quite difficult, how you approach it, you know, how you're able to set boundaries.
And it's still an advanced practice for me. And like even the terminology, like fawning and people pleasing, there's an element of shame, isn't there? It's like, oh, I shouldn't be fawning. Yeah. I shouldn't be people pleasing. What's wrong with me? Why do I keep betraying myself in order to? And it's like, well, we developed those ways of navigating life because at a pre-verbal age we learnt that our responses were not acceptable and we would either be punished or neglected. Mm-hmm. So we learnt that we had to be pleasing, we had to be caring, we had to, like, even potentially as babies, putting others' needs ahead of our own. So it's deep conditioning, and the idea of someone being displeased with us, it impacts us at an existential level. It's absolutely terrifying.
Yeah.
So again, the compassion, the recognizing, okay, so First of all, identifying what you want in any given situation, knowing what you want and what boundaries, like in an ideal world, if you weren't worried about any consequences, what would you be saying to who?
Yeah.
Who would you be swearing at or roaring at or just like encouraging like no contact, or who would you be wanting more like just connect with what you want? Like, I'm not suggesting you override what anyone else is wanting, but just to begin with, recognizing what you need and what you want, and knowing that that's okay, you have a right to your needs and wants, and then figuring out how best to communicate it to each person involved. But most of all, what I wish I'd known decades ago is that the setting off the boundary, the saying what you need, what you want, terrifying as that is, it's the having compassion for yourself, the holding yourself while you wait. Like, when you have grown up knowing that you're not safe to set a boundary, to say what you need, that can be incredibly triggering. And you might look fine and quiet and calm on the outside, but you might be spiraling and dying inside until you hear back from the other person that either they hear you and they're potentially confused, but they respect you and they'll give it a go, or their potential anger or their potential arguing and trying, like it might not suit them to accept boundary new you. So holding yourself, having support, knowing you are not wrong to want whatever it is you want, to need whatever it is you need. So having a good friend or therapist or coach or supervisor or cat diary, letting yourself express the messy hell of the in-between of setting that boundary and it being heard. And I just suddenly thought of, like, as therapists, often when we increase our prices, it can be a similar, like, you're changing your vibration, you're changing your energy. And I know anytime I increase my prices, there'll be a delay, like I might have a few days before I have another inquiry, or there's, it's like it has to catch up energetically. And it's the same with boundaries. The more you're reminding yourself you have a right to be safe, you have a right to be happy, you have a right to whatever preferences you have, and the more you are able to express no, the more you can also say yes, and the more the other people in your life can trust you, because no matter how people pleasy we try to be, that resentment comes out.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that sort of really, I mean, helped me a lot when we talked about it was just that acknowledgement that it does feel deeply uncomfortable. Yeah. But that doesn't mean that we have, that we should avoid it. You know, like you say, it's that need to hold yourself. Oh, this really is horrible. But, you know, in a sense, I'm honouring myself by doing it, and, you know, just acknowledging that it's hard and that it doesn't have to be easy for it to be a boundary that I'm going to set.
And it gets easier, but that doesn't mean that it gets easy. It will always, like, healing isn't linear. There'll be times where you think, oh my God, is this the first boundary I've ever set? But no, you have like 20, 30, 40, however, a year experience of honouring. And it does get easier. And also it becomes, I think, seeing everything as information. It's like taking the charge out of it. You decide, for example, that someone doing a specific thing hurts you, and you take that courageous step of voicing it to them. They have a choice. They can do the thing you've now requested that they do to show you the respect and care that you deserve, or they can continue to minimize how you're feeling. And that's information. It might not be the information you want, but it's information.
Yeah. And that gives you choices, really, doesn't it? And the other thing that's sort of coming to mind, I wonder if you'd like to share it, is you came into Therapy Growth Group, did this brilliant meditation about being a king or queen. That was amazing. Tell us a bit about that.
So it's a little bit, I guess, what I was saying earlier about the compassion versus empathy. Mm. When we're feeling safe, when we're connected, when we're empowered, we can connect with our inner sovereignty, whether that's your inner king or queen or non-binary ruler. But it's not about power over anyone else. It's of being of service.
Mm.
It's about recognizing the more we're all in our power, the more we can all contribute. So that really helped me because I grew up kind of royalty, like colonialism, like plunder, all of it. Like, how can we still be in this world where there's so much inequality?
Mm.
So I resisted the idea of that inner royalty, that inner sovereign. But it's treating yourself well. It's treating yourself as deserving, recognising. This is going to probably be quite controversial, but she keeps popping into my head.
Yeah.
I'm going to mention Taylor Swift.
Mm-hmm.
She is a very young woman. And from her teens, she has been leading her crew and her backup dancers and singers and all the rest with a real poise that has enabled her to, like, kind of sue that sexual predator for a dollar, to model what that could look like for other women and girls who haven't been believed, giving huge bonuses, donating enormous amounts to food banks in the cities where she was touring, mm-hmm. all these things. But also she has, like, buying back her music, helping younger artists recognize this was an exploitative practice,
mm-hmm.
and you do not have to be treated like that.
Mm.
She has an enormous amount of privilege. She's white. Her family were in a position where they could move to support her musical career at an early age. She's also worked incredibly hard, but I don't see her using her power or privilege to oppress anyone.
Mm.
She seems to be like, the more she has, the more she's able to give.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? Mm. Does that, like, yeah. I think especially as women, we are, and it makes me laugh because when I first went self-employed 2004, I went to New York City for a Women in Power conference organized by Eve Ensler, who had written The Vagina Monologues and created V-Day. And also Elizabeth Lesser of the Omega Institute. But the whole conference was women and power, and how, like, I met Gloria Steinem, Eve Ensler, like Sally Field, Jane Fonda. It was incredible and inspiring. But the gulf between what people were talking about, it took me decades to catch up with that. The more I am in my power, the more I can be of service.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, coming back to the cats, I don't see myself as Rainbow's owner.
Mm-hmm.
Some people would say that Rainbow sees herself as my owner. I see us more as friends.
Yeah.
But it's my job to keep the litter tray clean. It's my job to make sure she's fed. It's my job to firmly put her in the carrier when we're going to the vet.
Mm.
Or it's my job to put the, like, kind of flea and tick treatment on. But then it's also my job to respect her boundaries and ask, does she want to be scooped up for cuddles? Or does she, or like with the ferals, it's, we all know consent when we think about, would I like it done to me?
Mm-hmm.
Or, sorry, you ask a question, I go way off.
Well, no, it's just lovely listening to you, really. Yeah, I just think there's something really profound about being in our power as you're talking about it. And I know this idea of sovereignty, I mean, when you did it really did sort of help me. Because it just sort of gave me that question, you know, imagine that I was the sovereign. What would be my decision if this was my kingdom? And I think it's about, it just enabled me to get in touch with that wiser part of myself. And also to sort of see, I can remember one situation where I could see very clearly that I was being manipulated, you know, because when you've got that sense of, this is what I want, and you can see that it's, it almost, in a sense, you don't take things personally. You can see things better, can't you? And I could see how I was being manipulated in a situation. So that was a very sort of powerful, I think, intervention for me when you told us about that.
It's when it could be New Year thing. Sorry, I interrupted
you. No, go on.
Thinking New Year's Day or coming up to New Year, thinking, even if you don't see that in a king or queen right now, if you were to imagine that there is a part of you that has this wisdom, that has this leadership, that has this power, or it could be that more spiritual, that like highest self that I talk about, your miraculous self. But if you were to be connecting with those more powerful parts of yourself, what would you like the coming year to look like? Where would you like to be a year from now? How would you want to be contributing to making the world a better place for all of its inhabitants? How would you like your own life to be better? How would you like your family's, like, just allowing ourselves to be expansive and to recognize we have more power than we think.
And really sort of connecting with that part of ourselves, isn't it? This sense of, it's interesting actually, because just before, just recently, I was at the Vision Board workshop with Jane in the Therapy Growth Group, and she did this meditation which we were trying to sort of like, she said, you know, imagine this person that you want to be, and how can you bring yourself closer in a sense to that sense of that person? And again, that was quite a powerful sort of vision for me, really. And she said, how can you get in touch with the feeling of that person? And then the thing that was really powerful was the reminder that this person is not somebody who's separate from me. This is actually part of me, you know. And I just thought, wow, that's so, so powerful, isn't it? That, you know, when we can sort of touch that part of ourselves, that power within ourselves, it really... It I mean, powerful is a strong word, but that's how it felt. It felt very powerful for me. So,
And it might be that we're projecting it out, but it's part of the reason I love yoga nidras. It's known as yogic sleep, but they're guided visualizations. If people are interested, I've got loads of free ones on the website and on YouTube. But with the Sankalpa, you're thinking about that positive intention or resolve. You're saying it in the present tense as if it's already a reality, but you're recognizing in that state of deep rest, deep relaxation, you know you're not deluding yourself. You know that you're going to have to do actual things to make it a reality. But by connecting with your senses and like your feeling and just asking yourself, like, how does it feel when I imagine this being a reality? Like, how do I look? What can I see? How do other people see me? What am I hearing? What's my self-talk like? Any other sounds? What am I wearing? It can be as simple as footwear. A lot of women, especially, I remember Gloria Steinem in Revolution from Within, she'd done a future self meditation and she recognized that she was wearing flat shoes like decades in the future, and it was like, I'm gonna start now. Like, why am I making myself uncomfortable? But stop projecting your power outward. Think about the people you admire, think about the people who inspire you, and give yourself permission to recognize that even though there may feel like a big gulf between you and them, the qualities you're admiring in them are things that you have within yourself as well.
That's a really sort of powerful thought, isn't it? That those, and it often is that case, that we admire people, we admire them for their values, because those are our values.
It's a different kind of shadow work, but just as important as the kind of the things that we project out that we hate in ourselves. So
we sort of tend to notice those more than the powerful parts of ourselves, don't we? And I love what you said about, you know, noticing, you know, like you said, the shame spirals and the shoulds and the things that we, you know, beat ourselves up with, you know, be aware of those. So just as we sort of come to the end, because it's just flown by our time together, I'm just sort of wondering, Eve, what's one gentle first step that you would love therapists to take this month?
I think to just imagine yourself as a beloved kitten or puppy or toddler or lizard or giraffe or whatever kind of creature you love. And know that you are as deserving of that love, that tenderness, that curiosity. Like, you might not, you think about, I'm not a parent, but you think about parents when you become a parent and you suddenly have this creature you have to keep alive. You have to become very adept at understanding what different cries mean. Are they thirsty? Are they hungry? Do they need sleep? Do they need nappy changed? All these different things. It can feel as confusing and scary when we begin to connect with ourselves. But the more you can connect with that adorable part of yourself, like recognize you. I talk about like smelly cat as well, like just needs to go to the vet, just needs a clean, just needs some love. But under all the worst feelings we have, like we might feel disgusting and repulsive and like the smelliest cat alive. But if you imagine, if you remind yourself that you are as worthy as anyone else of that curiosity, of that compassion, of that tenderness, and begin to be a gentle, kind detective as you figure out what do you want, what do you need, and how can you begin to assert yourself and speak up for yourself and others. That wasn't one step, was it? That was several.
Well, I think it was, you know, imagine yourself, treat yourself as you would treat a beloved pet or animal or baby or little toddler. I think that is the first step, isn't it? Eve, how can people find out more about you?
So I think the main place would be selfcarecoaching.net. And that has links to the Feel Better Everyday podcast, the book. I do a column for Platinum every month, so you can find me there on social media. But yeah, the website, selfcarecoaching.net.
That's
it, has
start.
Everything.
It's a lovely
loads
website.
Of free resources. Oh, thank you.
Loads of free resources. And do you sort of have people can come on a newsletter list and get stuff every week, can't they?
Thank you. So I decided, done newsletters obviously over the decades, but maybe a couple months ago I've changed the focus to a kind of polyvagal informed gratitude practice. So it's not toxic positivity. It's I'm sharing some of what I'm grateful for because I know that helps me. And also some of the resources will hopefully help subscribers, but also connecting. So the gratitude, it moves us into that ventral vagal. That purr, that like helping to build on more of that. But also we want to recognize what's pissing you off, what's overwhelming you. So just a bit of a reality check. It lands every Monday at some point. It's not the same time every Monday, but Mila Buikos Mondays, that means 1,000 thank yous in Irish.
So
again, you can sign up through the website.
Well, thank you so much for coming along, Eve, and sharing. As I said, there's so much we could talk about. And another time, perhaps, we'll talk more about your practice itself and how you've grown your practice. But it's just really lovely to hear, you know, how to be kinder to ourselves, especially at the start of the year. And so, you know, with that little thought of imagine yourself as that baby or animal that needs love and compassion.
That needs and deserves it. And imagine like how your life might have been different if the adults around you had delighted in your uniqueness and everything. And like in terms of practice, the more you're yourself, the more enjoyable your work will be and the more you'll be resonating with the right clients for you, the right supervisees. So it's kind of win-win-win ripple effect.
Fantastic. Well, thanks so much for coming along, and I'll speak to you again soon, I know.
Well, I'll say Happy New Year because I know we're recording it before New Year.
It will be New Year when it comes out.
Thank you so much. Hope you had a lovely New Year. Thank you so much.
Thanks for coming. Before we finish, just a quick note that if you're looking for support to take small, manageable steps in your private practice, I run Therapy Growth Group. Next week, I'm starting the 12 Action Steps program again, and there's a link in the show notes if you'd like to take a look. Thanks for listening. Do come and join my Facebook community, Good Enough Counsellors. And for more information about how I can help you develop your private practice, please visit my website, josephinehughes.com. If you found this episode helpful, I'd love it if you could share it with a fellow therapist or leave a review on your podcast app. And in closing, I'd love to remind you that every single step you make gets you closer to your dream. I really believe you can do it.